I just can't have any social life right now.
Don't worry about it. We're just having coffee. We'll be antisocial.
Hello and welcome to A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. We're now in February and this is the espresso episode of our podcast. I'm once again joined by Sam. Hey, Sam.
Hey there, Matt.
And if any of you listened to our February main podcast on Second Chances, where we talked about two musicals, namely Dancer in the Dark and A Chorus Line, you probably noticed that we had lots of musical-y ideas percolating in our heads, and we thought we'd basically continue our conversation pretty much where we left it off. Isn't that right, Sam?
That is right. I think we both realized that we were fans and non-fans of musicals at the same time, I remember.
Exactly. It's kind of like almost we had to realize and accept and make peace with the fact that we are probably fans of musicals after all. So what we wanted to talk about is basically some of our formative musical experiences. So this is not so much a primer as in you should be going to see these musicals as soon as possible. It's more about how did we get to the point where we realized and accepted that musicals are not that bad after all. So let's perhaps start with you, Sam. What was your first musical experience or your first formative musical experience from what you remember?
I was trying to think back to the first time I listened to a musical recording or a recording of a musical, and it was on a record at my grandparents' place, and they often played West Side Story. And I think my very first memory of a musical is hearing all the famous ones, you know, and the ones that stuck were, of course, Maria, Tonight, America, Officer Kropke. There were a number of them. And I think my first impression of musicals was this Bernstein modernism, right? It's not the type of sappy 1950s musical that you might have had just before. So my first experience was very modern, I think, in terms of musical development. How about yours?
With me, it was basically Jesus Christ Superstar. And I think there's a bit of a story there. My dad was someone who would have liked to be a musician. He was born in a little town in southern Germany, and there basically being a professional musician was not an option unless you were rich, and his family definitely wasn't. He still got to learn to play the flute, and he basically played in wind orchestras mainly, but as an amateur, but it was basically his lifelong passion. And I think because of that, he had a lot of records back then, vinyls, obviously. And the vinyls that he had, I mean, yes, you know, it was the 70s or the early 80s. They had stuff like Boney M, obviously. But at the same time, a lot of the stuff that he had was orchestral music. Or then he had a fair number of musical recordings, you know, the original cast recordings. And one of those was Jesus Christ Superstar. And I remember as a kid that I'd sometimes sneak up to their bedroom, which was also where he had the records. And I'd check out those records and I'd listen to some of those. And Jesus Christ Superstar was one of those. I liked the music at the time. I'm not sure how much of the lyrics I understood because at the time my English wasn't that great. But I think a bit later, we used to get Betamax videos from my uncle in England. And one of the videos that we got at the time was a recording of Jesus Christ Superstar, probably off, I don't know, BBC or ITV or something. And I remember watching it and finding it fascinating. Basically, this very 1970s rock opera, music by Andrew Lloyd Webber, libretto by Tim Rice, which mixed the biblical story with basically elements of 70s culture, hippies. Also, the imagery was basically, it was filmed actually in Israel, Palestine, West Bank. So you had these images that are very much, you know, the biblical ones, but then you've got kind of hippie early Christians and, you know, Romans with machine guns, that kind of thing. And that fascinated me, that anachronism. Have you ever seen it?
I have not seen it yet. I'm just aware of the music, obviously, of some of the famous songs. But it's interesting that we both started out with a vinyl recording and actually didn't see the musical that was attached to it or the film that was attached to it for a while. For me, it took a while to see West Side Story as well. So I was very familiar with the music and then seeing for the first time the images to go alongside. I think that was quite a mind-blowing experience as well. It was also my grandfather that was the first one to have a video recorder, and we actually also saw West Side Story at their place afterwards. And I do remember really, really being amazed by the choreography, by the intensity of the dances, but also the romance, obviously, and this, again, hyper-modern New York backdrop these two gangs going at each other in such a aggressive yet very aesthetic kind of way. I think that was really also formative in a sense of how I imagined musicals to be like. And I feel the disappointment that is my later experience with musicals is that no other musical really is quite like West Side Story. I think still to this day, I find it quite unique in the way it combines romanticism, modernism, and this urbane backdrop. I think I've never seen anything like it since.
And of course, it's also Shakespearean. I mean, it is basically Romeo and Juliet. So there's all these influences, yeah. There's all these kind of tones, these styles that are mixed. And it shouldn't work, but it does. And I think part of that is obviously the music. I mean, Bernstein's music is still great, I think. I think it's also the lyrics. It's Sondheim who wrote those lyrics, right? And
yes.
A lot of them are very effective, clever, intricate. And I think that really still works very well.
And I think it's still, it keeps on giving. You know, even the fact that it was Romeo and Juliet in a modern way, I didn't realize that for the first few times I listened to it and saw it, I only realized it later. And the thing about Sondheim, I even realized much, much later to make the connection between, you know, Sondheim and West Side Story. It took me forever. And also Ernest, the fact that Ernest Lehman wrote the script, who also wrote a lot of the Hitchcock classic like North by Northwest or Family Plot, it just escaped me. And I think West Side Story is such a conglomerate of different elements that come together so successfully, and I can see why now, but it's kind of kept on giving over the years.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I mean, the thing with Jesus Christ Superstar is also that it was directed by Norman Jewison, who died relatively recently, I think in late January this year. And of course, when you think of Norman Jewison, you think of In the Heat of the Night or The Thomas Crown Affair, Moonstruck, but he also did Fiddler on the Roof, so another one of those big 70s musical movies. And Fiddler on the Roof is a very different beast from Jesus Christ Superstar. Jesus Christ Superstar, I think, very much breathes the 70s in its style. In that respect, it can also come across as dated, where Fiddler on the Roof goes much more for a kind of lyric realism with very little stylization, as you might expect. I think Fiddler on the Roof is also one of your early musical experiences, right?
It is. It's actually the second one on my list that I remembered. There was a performance of what is called Anatevka in the German translation of Fiddler on the Roof. And they had a performance at my secondary school, you know, in the countryside. They had a huge production because there was a teacher who really staged big productions of plays and also musicals. And so I remember just sitting there. I must have been 11 or 12 years old, and I was sitting beside, I don't know what you call it in English, actually, the singing saw. Is that an expression, you know, the instrument?
I think so, yeah.
And I sat beside the lady, or very close to the lady who was playing it in Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, cool.
And I think musically, that was such an interesting experience to have both the songs and the musical being performed on stage, but then also getting the details of, you know, how does one instrument, how do certain instruments play into it? I think that must have kind of inspired my interest in like film music as well, just to see what goes into creating a certain mood and atmosphere. And I think Fiddler on the Roof, I've not seen the film version with Chaim Topol yet. I'm going to see it with an orchestra this May, actually, for the first time.
Oh, nice.
But I'm very familiar with the songs, with the recording, with the John Williams adaptation, his Oscar-winning adaptation. So I'm really excited to now have all these pieces come together this year. What was the fascination for you with Fiddler on the Roof then? Did you see it early on?
I saw it early on. I have to say at the time I liked it, but I think it was just one of many things I watched at the time because we just got so many videos and when we received the videos from the UK, we just watched them and then we moved on. At the time, I think it was more stuff like the original Star Wars in a very bad recording, you know, with distortions and everything that stayed with me more than Fiddler on the Roof. But when I later revisited it, probably, you know, around 2000, I was struck by, I think it's got exactly the kind of thing that is necessary for me for a musical to work. Namely, obviously there's a certain kind of, how should I put this, unreality to musicals. People just burst into song. And that's something that we talked about in our last episode, that basically this heightened reality that comes with musicals, this heightened also emotionality. Again, I compare to Shakespeare in that respect, where you've got a heightened language. No one talks in iambic pentameters, but when it's done well, you feel obviously that's how you would talk. And with a musical, it's the same thing. Obviously, at this point, if you feel these feelings, you would burst into song. So it's kind of an internalized reality made external. And I think Fiddler on the Roof does that very, very well. And the film definitely does that very well. They've got great actors. It's beautifully filmed. The music, I think, still works very well. And it also has this kind of roller coaster ride of emotions. There's the elation of romance. There's the elation of youth. But then there's also the older people, the kind of frustration with a world that seems to be moving away from them and their children moving away from them literally at a pace that they just can't keep up with. And then obviously all these historical events that are happening at the same time. I think it does that very well, heightening things, making them universal while keeping them very, very specific. Also in the music, obviously. Although, I mean, specificity, I think Fiddler on the Roof has been accused of basically being, you know, it's a primer for non-Jewish people about Jewish culture. And there's probably something to that. But I think there is an earnestness to it that I think really works, at least for me.
Mm-hmm. And there's a fantastic set of songs in there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much that was memorable about just seeing it one time.
Yeah.
And I think just having it, I think we played the cassette recording of that performance at our home over and over again. So I was really aware of the tunes, but then it was a big gap until I actually came by the film recording and the fact that John Williams was involved, and it seemed very odd that he had adapted that score for the film. And I just recently bought the complete edition of all the songs from the film. And so it's kind of a rediscovery for me as well, which is nice about certain musicals that, again, keep on giving over the years. I think that's maybe one quality criterion that we can already see in our discussion.
Absolutely. But you mentioned before seeing these things also on stage. And of course, that is, I think, a very, very different experience, seeing a musical on stage or seeing it on film. And the first few musicals that I saw were definitely on video, as I said, Jesus Christ Superstar, Fiddler on the Roof. Also, Oliver was one that we watched because we got the video from my uncle. And I think the first one that I saw on stage was, again, Andrew Lloyd Webber. It was Cats at the time. That was a big hit. And then it made the tour through Europe. And then more memorably for me, actually, Phantom of the Opera. So again, Andrew Lloyd Webber. And I have to say that until I saw that on stage, I definitely had a kind of fascination with Andrew Lloyd Webber. I liked a lot of the music as a kid, as an early teenager, which says a lot about me as an early teenager. And Phantom of the Opera, seeing that on stage twice, not just once, but twice, was kind of a moment when I went off Andrew Lloyd Webber. Because the first time I saw it, we had great seats. I was fully in the illusion. Basically, the spectacle worked for me. I loved that experience. So I thought, I'll have to go and see it a second time. I went to see it a second time and I got not very good seats. They were cheaper. They were still okay. But the thing is, I was sitting further back and that basically revealed a lot of the stage illusion to me, exactly as illusion. And it fell apart completely. You know, there's this big scene where they dance. I think just after the intermission, I think it's Masquerade is the song. And I remember being totally in that scene the first time I saw it. And when I sat a bit further back for the second time, I realized half of the people on stage are actually not people. Half of the people on stage are mannequins. And I thought it was not done for the effect. It was done just to fill the stage. So you had more people in costume. And I think that's where really the illusion broke. And at the same time, somehow I realized that Andrew Lloyd Webber, he very often has 2-3 musical tricks up his sleeves. And he repeats them and repeats them and repeats them. And I think that was also partly where I didn't go off musicals because I had an ambivalent relationship to them anyway, but I definitely went off Andrew Lloyd Webber at the time. Mm-hmm. I think you also mentioned seeing Phantom of the Opera on stage, right?
We've lived parallel lives in that case. I also saw Cats first. I was 10 years old. My parents took us to London because they had met there so many years ago. And we went to see Cats and I sat in the first row in front of a hole where for the entire performance, the cats kept coming out. So here I am.
Oh, cool.
In the middle of London for the first time, 10 years old. And all these, you know, highly dressed up, highly stylized actors and actresses just coming out in their cat suits. And of course, I was completely mesmerized. And even though nowadays I don't care for Cats so much musically, but I think I will always remember that. So it's almost the opposite of what you experienced. That was like first row. 3 years later, we went back and also saw Phantom of the Opera. And it's the only time I've seen it. And I was also mesmerized. We had these great seats on the balcony, pretty close to the actual performance. And that makes me afraid now of seeing it again, because I've planned trying maybe to see it again. That very first time since, I guess, 1993, when it was still a huge hit in London. And I did like the experience of being in, you know, that the whole setup with the Paris Opera being the center of that entire show, and then having this performance within a performance, and the high drama of and the romanticism of the music of Andrew Lloyd Webber. And we had cassettes playing with a best of Lloyd Webber for many, many years after that. And I think that got me into a lot of the other musicals that I've actually never seen on stage. Maybe Evita later on. And I think that might have been the only Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, the only other one that I saw. But yeah, it's formative in a way that you're for the first time in these super highly professional musical environments of a city like London. And you just see what they're able to put on stage in terms of production values and just the size of the theaters. And I think that really got me for a while into the Lloyd Webber world, but I didn't really follow up on it. I think if I had, let's say, gone back to London, seen one after the other, I think they also had Starlight Express, which was fairly new at the time, or others that were still going on. I'm thinking of the Norman Desmond musical, what is it called? Sunset Boulevard.
Sunset Boulevard, yeah.
That would have been interested in seeing, but I just know some of the music, so I didn't become like a full-on musical fan. But there would have been the possibility, I think, at that point.
I think the whole London musical scene is also one of the things that put me off musicals, because it was just so clear that it was a big commercial machine for the tourists. Doesn't mean that there can't also be art history, but it just felt like, especially if you've got a hit movie, a hit story, it's turned into a musical because that will draw the crowds. And I think that's something that's just gotten worse, you know, in the sense that, for instance, oh, Shrek, you know, that was a big hit on screen. Let's turn it into a musical. Billy Elliot, people loved the film. Let's turn it into a musical. And it felt pandering. And I think that is something that really put me off, because also I think musicals can be highly commercial and pandering in a certain sense, in that very often you have this very conventional, I would even say heteronormative, kind of romanticism. It's usually those kind of stories, boy meets girl, and usually reduced to the cliches, to the tropes. And I think especially with what I heard of those musicals, I definitely missed the cleverness, for instance, in the lyrics that you did get with Sondheim's lyrics for West Side Story. I also think that Tim Rice did some really clever lyrics for the early Andrew Lloyd Webber stuff. And when you then basically turn the whole thing into a tourism machinery, you also start wondering, has it always been that?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is something that I find relatively off-putting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely agree. I saw the Back to the Future musical in London with my students last year, and it was just a case in point of that. All that was great about the musical was basically what they took off from the film, including some of the music, some of the songs, the theme, obviously. Everything they added in terms of new songs was just not memorable enough. And aside from the fact that they can do fantastic stage effects these days, including the DeLorean that, you know, flies off the stage. I mean, it's spectacular, but it's certainly not an original musical experience you have with, I'm thinking of Blood Brothers or Les Misérables that I saw later on, or Wicked, that I think were just great experiences on stage, and they were original, they felt fresh. And they didn't need to be made into films necessarily. They just work on stage and not, let's say, vice versa, adapting everything from Mrs. Doubtfire, Back to the Future and so on for the stage, or like you said, Shrek.
Exactly. But I mean, sometimes it can work. I remember that in the, I think, early 2000s, at a point when I still thought I don't actually like musicals all that much, I went to London with my now wife. And she's very much into musicals, so I thought, okay, let's check some of them out. And I think Blood Brothers was one that we saw at the time. And we also thought, why not go and see The Lion King? It was not completely new at the time, but it was still relatively recent. And obviously I'd read a lot about Julie Taymor's production of The Lion King, how it was basically, you know, very fresh, visually striking, with basically the actors not just made up as kind of lions or acting as humans, but having these masks, these kind of African-style masks, and the whole aesthetic was very much influenced by kind of African art, African folklore as well. And basically got great reviews at the time, so I thought, let's go and see that. I remember when the lights went down, there was a kid in the row just in front of us, and as the lights went down, the kid went like, I don't like lions. And I thought, okay, kid, perhaps the wrong musical for you.
Good luck to you.
Well, yeah. But then I thought, I'm here, I don't like musicals. Ah, well, let's see. I mean, we paid so and so many pounds. And I really liked that one because it definitely had a freshness. I mean, obviously it had been going for a while at that point already, but it was still visually striking. It had an aesthetic where you really had the impression this is not something that was done just by committee. They had an idea and they wanted to express that idea. And that really came through. It's also, I think, The Lion King, like so many of these Disney films, has very good, very strong music. Obviously, it's kind of a bit populist. It's, you know, the stuff that you hum on the way home. But I think, why not? If it works, it works. And I think that's also when I realized that all of those Disney films I've been watching were basically stealth musicals in the sense that, you know, you can easily say, I'm not into musicals. Of course, I'll go and see The Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin.
Yeah, those were exactly also the same that I saw year after year. I mean, for a while, Disney was just the staple to see at the end of the year, the new Disney movie. And they were fantastic musicals. I think the Alan Menken ones especially stood out to me in terms of the songs and the score quality as well. I remember seeing Beauty and the Beast, and it doesn't just work for the songs. It's also a beautiful score. And I think even The Lion King with the Hans Zimmer score just works on like two different levels, right? It's the songs, it's the Elton John, Tim Rice as well. And then the Hans Zimmer score that kind of molds the whole thing together beautifully. And I think between Little Mermaid and Lion King, I think I skipped Pocahontas and I didn't like Hercules. And then I kind of lost track of the regular Disney releases. Those are really also very formative in a sense of, yeah, like you say, stealth musicals.
And yeah, I mean, they definitely made it easy for people who say, oh, I don't like musicals, to go and still enjoy a good musical. And they were fun. I mean, after a while, I think they also became this machinery. I think also Tarzan and so on and so forth. You basically had the impression that they had a great start there with Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Aladdin, and then basically you had diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. You can't keep that kind of thing up. And I think it's also Alan Menken died, right?
Right. I would have to check when in the, you know, the course of these films, but I guess it's telling that they're reusing now the Alan Menken music and all the animation Disney's and making them into real life versions, but they'll run out of material pretty soon. I think the last really good one I saw was Mulan in the original version from the late 1990s. I remember seeing it as a world or a European premiere in Locarno at the film festival and being really impressed. But I think that was the last time I had a brush with a new Disney that I really, really liked as for its musical qualities.
I think it's also they started getting pop musicians. I mean, with Elton John, I think it kind of worked, although there the music was largely Hans Zimmer. Basically, in the film, the versions, they're very much the Hans Zimmer versions rather than the Elton John versions. But the more they also got pop musicians to write their music, I think the less it seemed to work, because writing pop music is not the same as writing good musical music, writing good songs that further the story, that express the characters. And in that respect, I think it makes sense that they later on started working, for instance, with Lin-Manuel Miranda, who did Hamilton. And he's done a number of these films now with Disney. And I think those work much better musically.
Absolutely. I think Hamilton, after many years of kind of staying away from musicals or regularly going to musicals when I was traveling or even around here in Switzerland, Hamilton is the latest musical I saw that was formative in that sense. That was something completely different, put on stage, American history, R&B songs, non-white cast, depicting something from a very different perspective, from a very modern point of view. And I think, again, one of these musical experiences where when you walked out completely emotionally shattered and just wanted to listen to all those songs again. I think there was a playlist of at least 8 to 10 songs from Hamilton that I kept on listening for days afterwards. So I feel there I got that sense again of a musical that really left a mark, really left an impression on me. And it hadn't happened in a long time. All I was doing was catching up on older musical, more classic musicals from the 50s, 60s and 70s. You know, Sound of Music, Cabaret, Yentl, the Gene Kelly musicals. And I think those were kind of my favorite musicals, but I had not really been keeping track of what had been going on Broadway or in musical theaters worldwide.
I have to say, we rewatched Yentl about half a year ago. And That one almost brought back my old I don't like musicals thing, because I have to say I have big problems with that one. It's definitely, you know, well-crafted in many ways, but I just find it so, it's so much the Barbra Streisand show and only the Barbra Streisand show, to the detriment, I think, of the story and the other characters to some extent. But I don't know, perhaps I was just, you know, 15-year-old Matt kind of rearing his head for a moment.
But it's interesting how these big performances in a way were something that I really liked. In other cases, I'm thinking of Liza Minnelli in Cabaret. She's also, you know, street sweepingly good and plays a huge role in the film. Or Julie Andrews in pretty much anything, Victor Victoria, Sound of Music, Mary Poppins. But they're just, I'm not going to say more likable, but they're just, they fit in much better as a character and with the rest of the film or the musical. And they're still great stage or musical performances, very memorable. But it's not only about them, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And I see that with Yentl, definitely. I mean, what remains is the songs that she's sung for that musical or for that film.
Mm-hmm. I think Cabaret for me was, I mean, when I saw Cabaret first, and that was also not too long ago, probably about 10 years ago, that was definitely one of the moments when I realized what musicals could be. I mean, I'm thinking especially of that song, The Future Belongs to Me.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that one? Because that's also when I realized musicals can be more than just vehicles for, let's say, romance and for relatively stereotypical romantic stories. Musicals can also use what they have at their disposal to make certain points. And I remember that scene was one that used music, that used song so well to make a really chilling point that I can't imagine that point being made without the music. I mean, obviously you can do it in different ways, but the effect as it is done there depends so much on the music and how you as an audience kind of take up music. And you might think, nice song, you can totally see that, and then it shifts into something before you realize it, and then you get this moment where you realize what it is you're watching.
Mm-hmm.
And I think musical is just used fantastically there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've just recently rewatched it over Christmas, and it's stunning the way it also intercuts then the developments of, you know, Weimar Germany towards Nazi Germany, and puts that in contrast so often with what's going on stage in those sometimes silly, sometimes sappy, sometimes just plain funny songs and performances. But at the same time, it's really also powerful to see both, you know, Joel Grey and Liza Minnelli on stage. But I think it also works really well as a story, how it's told around the other characters that have nothing to do with the musical performances. So I think in that sense, it also connects to probably my favorite formative musical of all time. And that would be Victor Victoria, which had a similar effect on me. It was about musical performances, but it was not necessarily people bursting into songs mid-scene, with a few exceptions. But it was basically, or it is basically, around these performances of Julie Andrews, Robert Preston and others in different clubs and theaters of 1930s Paris. But at the same time, there was, of course, also different strands of stories going on. There was a love story between Julie Andrews and James Garner. But there was also this very emancipatory and comedic take on gay life in 1930s Paris. And it had such a self-evident way it dealt with gay characters at the time. And I think we talked about this briefly in our last episode as well, that it was really, for me, growing up gay, it was really something to connect to for the first time in a non-serious, non-tragic way. And I think Robert Preston left such an impression on me for that. And apart from that, you know, Julie Andrews is fantastic in it. Henry Mancini, Leslie Bricusse score and lyrics is great. I still listen to it quite regularly. It had this brightfulness that I think both Cabaret and Victor Victoria have, despite also tackling some serious to very serious issues at the time. But they were just great as a whole package, I think.
We've got it recorded, but I haven't watched it yet. So I think I will have to basically put that much higher up on my list of things to see, especially after this conversation.
And I think you recently watched Sound of Music as well for the first time.
Exactly.
I remember. So those are really, I mean, you have to, even if you ended up disliking it. But I think you have to expose yourself. Those are really like great first-time experiences, I think.
One thing I just remembered, I mean, musical songs, of course, don't just pop up in musicals themselves. Have you seen the Noah Baumbach film Marriage Story with Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson?
Not yet.
Because that is one, I mean, I can definitely recommend it as a film. I think it's very good. But it's in that film, you've got certain songs popping up from Stephen Sondheim's Company. And I think it's an interesting thing because it uses them not just as, you know, oh, remember this song. It uses them also to some extent to express something about the characters. And I thought that was interesting. It was almost like the film in two or three scenes turns into jukebox musical in ways that are really fascinating. And I think that's something you don't often have. I mean, I'm also thinking of things like Magnolia, the P.T. Anderson film, where you've got one scene where all the characters burst into song and it totally breaks with any realism in the film and it totally works as a musical scene. So I think to some extent, I wish directors did that more often, that they didn't just say, oh, this is a musical, this is not a musical, but that they also played with the form in films that are not musicals on the whole. I think anyway, film should much more often move away from the kind of narrow realism that it does. And I think musical could help there.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. The only other example I remember is Everyone Says I Love You by Woody Allen, who did a similar thing with characters breaking into song. And I think there was a certain irony to it because obviously they were not musical actors. Some of them couldn't really sing well, but it had a certain charm and it was a kind of a meta comment on what musicals do without being an actual musical. And I think that worked well as a concept. And I'd like to see more of that for sure.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I guess we're, again, full of ideas of musicals to watch, musicals to rewatch. Who knows, we'll have to perhaps do another episode just on more musicals that we've watched.
Or musicals we shouldn't watch.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we could do the opposite. Stay away from these musicals, please.
I almost did a bit of that when we did our last episode because you mentioned Rent, and I absolutely hate Rent. The film more so than the stage musical. I find it dreadful.
I'd get started with Mamma Mia, the musical, probably, first things.
So, once again, it's been great talking to you about musicals and about films.
Same, Matt, same.
And thank you very much, as always, to our audience. We will be back again very, very soon with more damn fine cups of culture. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.